This is Biblical Wisdom, an online Bible study with Dr. John Collins.
Okay, well, of course, it isn't really Solomon. The book called The Wisdom of Solomon is the only one of the wisdom books that was actually written in Greek. And Solomon sure as hell didn't write anything in Greek. You know, this is a book that was written around the time of Christ. Probably, I would guess, about a decade later than Christ, but right about that time. And before I get started on it, I should tell you something about Hellenistic Judaism. Because in the Hellenistic age, which is to say after the conquest of Alexander, so beginning a little before 300 BCE, when Alexander went to Egypt, founded Alexandria, and then a lot of Jewish people, a lot of Judeans, migrated to Egypt, as indeed did many other of the small peoples in the region. This was the new opening, the new opportunity. Now, Alexandria then became a great hub of Hellenistic civilization in that part of the world. And the Jewish community prospered in Alexandria. They got in well with the Ptolemies. A lot of them were mercenaries. They were very supportive of the Ptolemies. And they had a flourishing culture. It's hard for me to avoid comparing it to 19th century Germany. That this was, you know, a Jewish community that was, it didn't lose its own identity, but it did assimilate to a degree. They wanted to perceive themselves as being both Greek and Jewish, and they did not see a contradiction between those. They translated their Bible into Greek, called the Septuagint, and then they produced a vast literature. You know, a literature about as extensive as the Bible in what has come down to us, although a lot of it is fragmentary. And most of that literature was very positive about Greek culture. As somebody said, what was Plato but Moses speaking Greek? So the assumption was that Plato and Moses were essentially saying the same thing. Now, you may say that's a bit of a stretch, but this was, you know, a positive hermeneutic. It was a positive attempt to translate one culture into another. And they were doing just fine until the Romans came in. The Romans conquered Egypt in 31 BCE. Antony and Cleopatra. And after that, things went downhill a bit for the Jewish community because the Jews tended to support the Romans. They opened the gates of Alexandria to Julius Caesar. And this was resented by the Alexandrians. And then the Jews were perceived as a foreign body. And as the privileges of the Greeks in Alexandria were cut back, they resented the Jews all the more. And in 38 of the Common Era, there was what we might well call a pogrom in Alexandria, an attack on the Jewish community. And a lot of it, as I say, was this resentment on the assumption that Jews were somehow being favored by the Roman Empire. I should mention in this context that one of the prominent people in the Jewish community at the time was a man named Philo, who was a philosopher, arguably the only significant Jewish philosopher in antiquity. And Philo's mission in life was to translate the Bible into Greek, to interpret it in terms of Greek philosophy. And the way he did that was by allegorical interpretation, which was very respectable at the time, which meant that, you know, Moses didn't really mean what he said. He meant something symbolic. So, and you get this in other Jewish writings of the time too, that if Moses forbids eating certain types of food, say shellfish, or certain types of birds, this isn't because of superstition. This is because they have some symbolic significance. So there was a great effort to both maintain a distinct Jewish identity and at the same time try to make it seem respectable to the Greeks. Now, this is the world out of which the wisdom of Solomon comes. My guess is that this was composed around the time of that pogrom, or a little after that pogrom in Alexandria, because you do find evidence in it of tensions between Greeks and Jews, which you don't find in the earlier literature. Philo, the philosopher, was actually part of a delegation sent to Rome to plead the case of the Jewish community with the emperor Caligula. And that didn't really go so well. But you know, this was the kind of spirit of the time. Now, the wisdom of Solomon and Philo did not, for that reason, give up on the idea of believing that the Jews were actually the best form of Greek civilization. You know, that the Jewish religion was the highest form of Greek philosophy. Now, needless to say, not too many people who weren't Jews actually believed that. But that was the interpretation. And as I say, it reminds me an awful lot of what went on in Germany in the 19th century. And indeed, unfortunately, the outcome was a bit similar too. Because 100 years after Philo, that community was wiped out. Now, that was due to circumstances largely beyond their control. Some of it was spillover from the revolts in Judea, and then a lot of people from Judea migrated to Alexandria. But, you know, they fell out with the Romans, which was not a safe thing to do at that point in time. So this is all by way of setting the stage a little bit for the wisdom of Solomon. Now, you know, in most of the wisdom literature, I have told you, historical context really doesn't matter that much. They're trying to speak about human nature as such. And to a great degree, the wisdom of Solomon is trying to do that too. But in this case, I think, you know, the historical circumstances just intrude themselves and you can't avoid them. Now, I should also say something about the intellectual context of this book. Because, you know, with the book of Proverbs, the intellectual context is mainly provided by a tradition of wisdom teaching that we know from ancient Egypt, to a much lesser degree from ancient Mesopotamia. It has some things in common with what we know as the Bible, but a lot of it is just common Near Eastern wisdom. Now, in the wisdom of Solomon, there's much more by way of, shall we say, philosophical pretension. That in this case, you know, they are trying to do something that is in dialogue with much more sophisticated philosophical thought. And now, part of that is the heritage of Plato. I assume you all know a little bit about Plato. At least that he taught the immortality of the soul, that he taught that there was a spiritual world beyond this one. And the Jews in Alexandria found that very attractive. And they figured that this was essentially the same thing that Moses was saying. Again, you may say that's a bit of a stretch, but this was how they saw it. The other current in Greek philosophy that is very influential and very similar in many ways to wisdom literature was Stoicism. And the Stoics had the idea of the spirit or pneuma that was spread through the world, sometimes also called the logos, translated as the word in the Gospel of John. But the logos was also the rational spirit pervading the universe. Now, in the Wisdom of Solomon, you take these two things and combine them. And I would say the prevalent wisdom on this nowadays is that you get around the first century of the Common Era, you have an intellectual development called Middle Platonism, because the Stoics believed in this spirit or logos that pervaded the world, but they did not have another god above that. Whereas Plato did have a transcendent god. Now, Middle Platonism was the attempt to have that both ways, to affirm both the cosmic spirit, the spirit, the divine spirit in the universe, and also a god above it. And some people would even argue that Middle Platonism was essentially a Jewish phenomenon, because Philo and the Wisdom of Solomon have that taking wisdom as the spirit of God that pervades the world. And then there is still a transcendent God above that. But in fact, the God that you come in contact with, if you're living on earth, is wisdom, is the spirit in the world, rather than the transcendent deity. Now, the Book of Wisdom, as we know it, has three fairly distinct parts. The first half, roughly chapters 1 to 5, is the Book of Eschatology. It has to do with death, afterlife, and such matters. The middle part in chapters 6 to 9 is the Book of Wisdom, which talks about wisdom in terms that have a certain amount in common with wisdom as we met it in Proverbs chapter 8, but also a lot in common with Stoic philosophy. And then in chapters 10 to 19, you have what many people have called a midrash on Israelite history, taking Israelite history as the manifestation of wisdom in the world. This, again, you might say, was a bit of a stretch, but this, again, was how they saw it. So we will start here with a quick look at the opening of the book. Love is ostensibly addressed to the rulers of the earth, and you see it's ostensibly Solomon speaking. Love righteousness, you rulers of the earth. He is found by those who do not put him to the test. Perverse thoughts separate people from God, because wisdom will not enter a deceitful soul or dwell in a body enslaved to sin. Now, that touches on what is wisdom here? Much more than in any earlier book, wisdom is a spirit. And it is almost physical. It says here in verse 6, chapter 1, verse 6, wisdom is a kindly spirit, but will not free blasphemers from the guilt of their words, because the Spirit of God has filled the world. I don't know how many of you are familiar with the traditional liturgy for Pentecost Sunday, but this is the introit of the Catholic Mass, in that the Spirit of God has filled the world. And that which holds all things together knows what is said. Now, when it says, so wisdom is that which holds all things together. It's making the point here that the universe is bugged, so to speak. Whatever you say, don't believe you have any privacy. You know, this was the internet before the internet. That there is no privacy in this world. The Spirit of God knows everything that is said. But the idea is that wisdom is a spirit that is spread through the world and enters into people to the degree that they accept it. And by entering into people, it makes them wise and makes them friends of God and makes them immortal. And then the salvation of the world is the multitude of wise people. The more people who are dominated by the spirit of wisdom, the better the world is going to be. So it's like the Christian idea of grace is similar to this. You know, it's a spirit that spreads through the world and transforms it. The main description of wisdom here in the so-called Book of Wisdom is in chapter 7, verse 22. There is in her a spirit that is intelligent, holy, unique, manifold, subtle, mobile, clear, unpolluted, distinct, invulnerable, etc., etc., and penetrating through all spirits. For wisdom is more mobile than any motion. Because of her pureness, she pervades and penetrates all things. She is a breath of the power of God. Now, you know, it's a spirit, but spirit has a physical component, so to speak. You know, it's like a very fine substance that can pass through your skull and get into you. That's how they conceive of wisdom. And then a person, you know, who lives a good and righteous life, lets this spirit kind of flow through them. And that is how they are transformed and become quasi-divine. Back to chapter 1, verse 12. Do not invite death by the error of your life or bring on destruction by the works of your hands, because God did not make death and he does not delight in the death of the living. He created all things so that they might exist, and the forces of the world are wholesome. Now, to say that God did not make death flatly contradicts the Old Testament or Hebrew Bible. It contradicts Ben Sira, who said that, you know, this is just the good pleasure of the Most High, that whether life is for 10 or 100 or 1,000 years, you have to die at the end of it. No, says the wisdom of Solomon, God did not make death. But I think, you see, the wisdom of Solomon meant something different by death. It didn't just mean when you start breathing, it meant the death of the soul. Now, most of the Hebrew Bible or the Old Testament didn't really have a concept of the soul. They had some concept of a nephesh, which is sometimes translated as soul, but it's some kind of, you know, the breath, the life breath in people. But it's not like the Greek idea of the soul. But the wisdom of Solomon does have such an idea. And I think that's what it means when it says that God did not make death. The ungodly by their words indeed summoned death and made a covenant with him. Now, why did the ungodly summon death? Because they reasoned unsoundly. Now, no previous wisdom book, I think, would have said that. This is much more philosophical. But the idea here is nobody deliberately chooses to do what is evil. So if you do, no matter how horrible what you do may be, you think of it as being in some way good. And this, says the wisdom of Solomon, is not reasoning soundly. And it goes on then to lay out what it sees as the essential argument that determines how well you live. Short and sorrowful is our life. There is no remedy when a life comes to an end, and no one has been known to return from Hades. We were born by mere chance, and our name will be forgotten in time. So if you think that, as probably most people do in the modern world, Then what's your inference according to the wisdom of Solomon? Come therefore, let us enjoy the good things that exist. Let us take our fill of costly wine and perfumes. Let us crown ourselves with rosebuds before they wither, and let none of us fail to share in revelry. Gather ye rosebuds while ye may. So enjoy life while you can. That's all there is to it. That actually isn't so far removed so far from Koheleth. But the unrighteous in the wisdom of Solomon go on, and they say, let us oppress the poor, the righteous poor man, and let us not spare the widow, and let our might be the law of right. Now, I think this chapter is actually influenced by Plato's Republic, because in Plato's Republic, the argument is put forward that might is right. And heaven knows that argument is still put forward and put forward in political programs in very much the present day. And so that's what the wisdom of Solomon lifts up, you know, as the antithesis of the righteous person. Let us wait, let us lie in wait for the righteous man, because he is inconvenient to us and opposes our actions. It isn't altogether clear from this, you know, who are the people who are attacking the righteous man? You might think that there were other Jews here, but not necessarily. It's just not clear. He professes to have knowledge of God and calls himself a child of God. He has become a reproof to our thoughts, and he boasts that God is his father. This, incidentally, is quoted in the Gospel of Matthew as part of Jesus' words on the cross. Let us see if his words are true. Now, you know, in the book of Job, Satan put it to the Lord, you don't know whether Job is really righteous or not, because he's benefiting from it. If you want to know whether he's really righteous, put him in a situation where he's losing everything. And that's also essentially what Plato says in the Republic. He says, you know, if you want to know whether somebody is righteous or not, he mustn't be gaining anything by it, and he mustn't even be thought to be righteous. He mustn't even be getting a good reputation out of it. Now, similarly here, and it says, if the righteous man is God's child, he will help him and will deliver him from the hand of his adversaries. Thus they reasoned, but they were led astray, for they did not know the secret purposes of God. For God created us for incorruption and made us in the image of his own eternity. But through the devil's envy, death enter the world, and those who belong to his company experience it. This is actually the earliest passage that takes the snake in the Garden of Eden as the devil. You also get it in the book of Revelation in the New Testament. And that, says the wisdom of Solomon, is how death entered into the world. But God made people for immortality. It's kind of questionable exegesis of the book of Genesis, but it's the exegesis, I suppose, that was prevalent at the time. And then it goes on in chapter 3, in, you know, I think a classic passage if you need a text to read at a funeral. The souls of the righteous are in the hand of God, and no torment will ever touch them. Now, I suspect that this was probably written after the pogroms in Alexandria in 38, when people who seemed to be doing everything right, people who were keeping the law, people who were righteous and so forth, were killed. And how do you make sense of that? Now, you see, the book of Job would say, tough, that's the way it is. The book of Koheleth would say, well, I mean, who knows? But again, essentially similar to Job. Ben Sira would say, oh, but when the wicked people die, they feel much worse. And if you can believe that, good for you. The wisdom of Solomon, however, has a few more intellectual tricks in his toolkit. One of them is the author of this book knows Greek philosophy, knows Plato, and that knows the idea of the immortal soul. And that opens up for him the possibility that a person who is killed in this world may still end up happy and victorious. And the same idea had begun to catch on in Judaism from about the 2nd century BC in the apocalyptic literature. For example, in the book of Daniel and in the books of Enoch. And there is a judgment scene here in chapter 5 of the Wisdom of Solomon that draws quite directly on the judgment scene in the book of Enoch, or is very similar to it at any rate. And so by the time the Wisdom of Solomon was written, the idea of a judgment of the dead had gained some purchase. For Ben Sira, this is just a newfangled idea and you don't put any confidence in it. And neither does Koheleth. But for the Wisdom of Solomon, this is, you know, an intellectually superior position, so to speak. And for the Wisdom of Solomon, this is the precondition, really, of living a righteous life. If you take the Wisdom of Solomon at face value, if you don't believe in an afterlife, you have no reason to do one thing rather than another. Mind you, for 2,000 years before that, people in the Jewish tradition had not believed in an afterlife and presumably had still tried to live decent lives. There have been lots of people in the world who haven't believed in an afterlife and still try to live decent lives. But this is the position of the Wisdom of Solomon, and it would be enormously influential, especially in Christianity, I think more in Christianity than in Judaism, to the point where a lot of people would think that if there isn't an afterlife, why should you bother? So it goes on here, like, having been disciplined a little, they will receive a great good, because God tested them and found them worthy of himself. Like gold in the furnace, he tried them. That language is actually quite similar to what you find in the book of Daniel. In chapter 4, better childlessness with virtue. For the memory of virtue is immortality. Now, you see, again, this would have been quite heretical for most of the Old Testament. For most of the Old Testament, your immortality is your children. That's how you live on. That's it. But, says the Wisdom of Solomon, no, not so. It is better, you know, if living virtuously means you don't have any children, so be it. That is better. Because, you know, the goal of life in most of the Old Testament is to live long in the land and see your children and your children's children. And in the Hellenistic period, both in the apocalyptic literature and here in the Wisdom of Solomon, the goal of life is to live, to have an immortal soul, living in the presence of God and the angels. That's a whole different ball game. I don't think all that many people in the modern world really believe that the goal of life is to go to heaven when you die. I may be wrong on that. You don't see that advertised much in the media, shall we say? But, you know, it has been the traditional slogan of Christianity, of what it's about. And it's a very different view of life, and it's something that changes your values rather radically. In chapter 5, you have then this judgment scene when the righteous will stand with great confidence and the wicked will just be astonished. Because they will think they had, the wicked will think they had it made in this world and that the righteous were of no consequence. And then at the judgment scene, all of that gets to be reversed. In 5:15, but the righteous live forever. Their reward is with the Lord. The Most High takes care of them. Therefore, they will receive a glorious crown and a beautiful diadem and so forth. And so things are not what they seem in this world. This, I think, is actually a fairly radical departure from the earlier wisdom books, which were very this worldly in their orientation. But here in the Wisdom of Solomon, you know, what you see in this world doesn't ultimately matter. It's the spiritual world that counts. Now, I will skip forward a little bit here, skip forward, I think, over the whole Book of Wisdom, so-called. There are a couple of important lines in there, like the idea that the perishable body weighs down the soul, which is something you can all experience for yourselves from time to time. But beginning in chapter 10, then, it sets about retelling what we might call the biblical history. But the remarkable thing about it is there are no names mentioned. So in chapter 10, wisdom protected the first formed father of the world when he alone had been created and delivered him from his transgression. Who was the first formed father of the world? Well, presumably Adam. Did you know that wisdom had delivered him from his transgression and given him strength to rule all things? Well, you mightn't have gotten that from Genesis, but you get it here, because everything that happens in the world, everything that happens in what we might call salvation history, according to this book, is really the work of wisdom. That is how God operates in the world. When an unrighteous man departed from her in his anger, that's Cain, he perished because in rage he killed his brother. When the earth was flooded because of him, wisdom again saved it. So it's wisdom saved the world from the flood. And so on it goes. And then it will refer to the holy people, the righteous people, when you know very well that what they're talking about is Israel or the Jewish people. But, you know, it tries to transform all of this into a general statement of what is good and bad and right and wrong. In chapter, well, beginning maybe in 11:23, you are merciful to all. This is now explaining the plagues that God sent against Egypt. And it's really, there was so much less than what God could have done. The idea is God could have nuked them, but he doesn't. Instead, he sends mice and God knows what. And because you are merciful to all, for you can do all things. You overlook people's sins so that they may repent. For you love all things that exist and detest none of the things that you have made. Oh, I think that's a fine and uplifting thought. It's kind of an inspiring thought that God hates none of the things that he has made. That means also hates none of the people that he has made. For how would anything have endured if you had not willed it? But then, having said that, it goes on a few verses further down in chapter 12. Those who lived long ago in your holy land, you hated for their detestable practices. And you want to say, what? Wait a minute. I thought you just said God didn't hate any of the things that he had made. And the rejoinder is, but it's the Canaanites I'm talking about. Even God can't stand the Canaanites. This, it seems to me, you know, is just human nature. But on the one hand, you have, as I say, a fine and uplifting idea that God hates nobody. God wants all, God loves all humanity. God wants to save everybody. And then, oh, but the Canaanites, he couldn't possibly love them. So, you know, this is one of those tensions that you find in this literature between a fine ideal and then, you know, the human prejudices in practice. This was not the last book to think that those who lived long ago in your holy land you hated, that hated other people who lived in that particular part of the world. But the hatred really comes just, I think, in large part from competition for the same ground. It's ethnic prejudice, and it cuts both ways. But anyhow, it goes on here, and I'll skip on for the moment to chapter 13. Which is one of the more philosophical passages in the book. For all people who were ignorant of God were foolish by nature, and were unable from the good things that are seen to know the one who exists, nor did they recognize the artisan while playing heed to his works. Now, if any of you ever studied any philosophy, you'll be familiar with this kind of argument. It's the basic argument of natural theology, that the construction of the world presupposes that there is a divine architect, that there is a mind behind it all. And the assumption of the wisdom of Solomon is that you should be able to arrive at the knowledge of God by contemplating the beauty of nature. For in verse 5, for from the greatness and beauty of created things comes a corresponding perception of the Creator. The word for corresponding there is analogos. By analogy, you arrive at the knowledge of the Creator. Now, I think, you know, if you were to compare the Catholic Bible and the Protestant Bible, this may be the most significant verse for what's different in the Catholic Bible. The idea that you can arrive at the knowledge of God by analogy from the created order. This, then, Jew, was not especially typical, I would say, of the Hebrew Bible. And it's something that, by and large, I think Protestant theology has not tended to accept. Maybe some exceptions. But this was the idea that you get here, and it would be hugely important then for Christian theology right down through the Middle Ages. The idea that you arrive at the knowledge of God by analogy from the things that are created, from the greatness and beauty of created things. And then it says, you know, that so it's blaming people who were so wise in so many ways, but nonetheless didn't arrive at the knowledge of God. And yet it says, yet again, not even that while they live among, yet these people are little to be blamed, for perhaps they go astray while seeking God and desiring to find him. Yet again, not even they are to be excused, for if they had the power to know so much, they could investigate the world, how do they fail to find sooner the Lord of these things? And it kind of leaves you there hanging between the two options. Are these people to be blamed or not? To my mind, what's more remarkable here is the fact that it has some sympathy for the philosophers, you know, who failed to find God, but at least were trying. But it's not total endorsement of them either. It's also saying, but they really should have succeeded in it. But I think this is maybe the, one of the fundamental impulses in this book and in a lot of the wisdom literature, the idea that you can know God by analogy with the created order. The book goes on then to go through the whole story of the Exodus, culminating with the miracle of the crossing of the Red Sea. In chapter 19, verse 6, the whole creation in its nature was fashioned anew, complying with your commands, so that your children might be kept unharmed. Now, at no point in the second half of the book here does it ever mention anybody by name or say, it's the Israelites I'm talking about. It's your children. So in principle, this applies to any good people. But this is the ambivalence of the book, because there is also the assumption that the good people are Israel and a particular nation, a particular faith, whatever you want to call it. So there is an inherent tension between a kind of universalist endorsement of humanity and a very particularist affirmation of the priority of individual people. And then what happens at the end is the elements change places with each other. And it's an attempt, I think, to try to, to preserve somehow the laws of nature and at the same time allow for miracles. You know, because it doesn't want to say that God disregarded the laws of nature. No, he just moved things around. He just had things change places with one another. And this, I think, is fairly typical of this literature, you know, that they want to try to make sense in a way that Greeks and non-Jews would also understand. Although how successful they were at that is kind of questionable, because we don't really hear of any non-Jews being particularly impressed by it. Now, at that point, we come to the end of our examination of the wisdom tradition in the major wisdom books of the Bible and Apocrypha or Deuterocanonical books. What is distinctive about them? I would say the most distinctive thing about them is they don't posit a special revelation. The assumption is that what you need to know is really available to everybody. What you need to do is observe the way nature works, the way the created order works, and from that you should be able to arrive at the knowledge of right and wrong and the knowledge of God. Now, that's quite different from the whole biblical tradition that says, no, God came down on Mount Sinai and told people to live in a completely different way. It's assuming that revelation is harmonious with nature, or to put it another way, that revelation is built into creation itself. And it's because of that, I think, that it was possible for Christian theology down through the centuries to synthesize theology and philosophy, if you think that was a good thing. But this was how you could do it. It's the assumption, you know, that creation is one, and that therefore, you know, truth and revelation are all to be found in the same way. When Ben Sira said that all wisdom is the law of Moses, he meant that all wisdom, wherever you can find it, will lead you to the same place as the law of Moses. That's also what Philo of Alexandria said, and that, I think, is what the wisdom of Solomon is saying. And that, I think, is very different from some of the more prophetic strands of the Hebrew Bible that tend to pit revelation against nature. And that, I think, is probably where its enduring significance lies.
Thank you for joining us. Please visit us at yalebiblestudy.org.